This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Kent Thomas, founder and chief executive of Advanced CFO Solutions. Over the past 6 months, you've heard us chat on the show with entrepreneurs who have taken their companies from just an idea to something worth tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or even $1 billion. All these companies have one thing in common. They all need timely, accurate, and actionable financial and business information to run their companies. Done well, this information provides valuable feedback on what is going well, what needs to improve, and strategically, where the company should go next to thrive. This work is typically the job of a company CFO, its chief financial officer. Unfortunately, most small and mid-sized companies simply cannot afford the services of a full-time experienced CFO. This is where Advanced CFO Solutions come in. They provide access to top-tier CFOs on a part-time basis to companies who simply cannot afford a full-time CFO yet. Kent's strategy is working. Advanced CFO Solutions' list of past clients include a who's who of fast-growing, successful companies such as Ancestry.com, Skullcandy, Control4, and many more. In addition, Advanced CFO Solutions has helped over 200 clients raise over $1 billion of capital through the years. Kent, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Doug. It's great to see you again, and it's fun to be here.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us. Let's start. I gave a little bit of an intro about what Advanced CFO Solutions does, but when you're talking to somebody that's not in the business, you're at a party and somebody asks, what do you do? How do you explain what are the services that Advanced CFO Solutions does?
You know, really boiled down, you did a good job. We offer the chief financial role and, frankly, much more to companies that don't need or can't afford that role internally, either part or full time. One of the things that we see is small companies, when they're starting up, number one, in many cases, they don't understand how important good financial statement and financial information is. Number two, if they do, they can't afford to hire someone really good, so they'll hire what they can afford, and they typically don't get what they need. So the whole concept of Advanced CFO Solutions is to provide companies what they need when they need it, and they only pay for what they need. So we can provide from the lowest level accounting and bookkeeping to controller level to high-level CFO and do it for a fraction of the cost of actually even a full-time bookkeeper.
So let's say I think the point you made about the value of good financial information. I think most people out there are thinking, well, you know, income statement, cash flow statement, balance sheets, end of the year comes out and 90 days later they have these financial statements. And that's a necessary part of what you do, but that's a very small part of the value that you add. What is the value of having good financial information, and what do you mean by good financial information?
That's a great question, Doug, and you're right. It actually is a minuscule part of the value add. Here's how we see it. You have to produce financial statements because bankers need them. You need to file tax returns. You need to have information available. But frankly, to a CEO or a founder, financial statements aren't very valuable. I talk to them all the time, and I find that they'll spend usually 15 minutes or less looking at the financials at the end of the month. And when I ask the question, have you ever thought about how much it cost you to produce those financial statements to get 15 minutes of value? Typically what they say is, I don't like where this is going, Kent.
Right.
but that's the reality. So maybe I can give you an example of a company.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful for folks.
So they can see where the real value is. So we help companies get their financial statements, and I was speaking at an event down at Utah Valley University one time to a bunch of entrepreneurs. When I got through speaking, a gentleman came up to me and he said, Kent, I wish I had known you a year ago. You probably could have helped me save my company. I thought, oh, that's terrible. I'm sorry. Tell me the story. I said, when did you close it down? He said, well, I'm really about to start that. Maybe I should hire you to help me. And I said, before you do that, let's sit down and talk. I'll give you a couple of hours free of charge. Let's just talk and see where you're at. We'll make a very long story short. We met. I asked him simple question, what do you do? What do you sell to whom and who are your customers? It became apparent very quickly that he had three channels he was selling into. His own salespeople, sort of the feet on the street, the own direct sales force. He was selling through a partner channel, wholesale distribution, and then he was selling on the internet via the web. And as we talked about, I said, well, let's look at each channel separately. He had no concept of what I was talking about, and certainly no financial statements to show that. His financial statements, which he was getting every month, were pretty timely, fairly accurate, and they showed the company was flat on revenue and barely break even, losing a little bit, making a little
bit. But they were rolling those three channels into
all
one.
All three together. Right. And my point is that when you look at them all together, you get a different story than when you break them out. Yeah. Over the course of the next week and a half, we helped him break those out to see revenue, cost of goods sold, and gross profit margin by channel. And when we did that, something really interesting came up. The first thing we noticed is that the revenue in the primary channel where he started, which was direct sales, was declining on a month-over-month basis, year-over-year. He didn't know that. The second one was in the second channel, which was through the distribution partner. Revenue was static, but gross margins weren't very good because he had to sell it wholesale. The other thing is that in the third channel, in the e-commerce channel, revenue was growing rapidly, but the gross profit margin was the lowest of the three, which made no sense to me. Mm-hmm. I would expect that to be the highest.
Right.
No direct cost, commissions, and other things associated with it. And it was a total surprise to him as well. He had no idea. But as we talked about it, found out that the person who got him started on the web, some marketing consultant, convinced him that he needed to lower his price way down or people wouldn't buy on the internet. Maybe that was a great idea for 2 months. It wasn't a great idea for 3 years. So his first reaction to that, and this is where the story gets interesting, was, we're going to shut down the internet. I'm through because I'm not making any money there. I said, no, wait, let's do a little bit more analysis. So we got down to what I call a contribution margin. Gross revenue, cost of goods to gross profit, and then all the direct expenses that are variable and would go away if we stopped that channel. So if he closed it, what would go away and what would stay? We only want to see, because below that is the contribution that that channel is making to the overall business.
Yeah.
When we did that, we found out that the e-commerce channel was actually losing money on a contribution margin basis on every sale that it made. That made him even more convinced he wanted to close it down. What I said, though, is, hey, raise your price.
Yeah,
bring your
works.
Price up. And he said, well, no one will buy. Well, my response was, all the better, right? Better to sell nothing at zero than to lose money on every deal. He raised his price, lost the revenue decline was somewhere between 5 and 7%, not that bad. What we ended up doing after when it was all said and done is we closed Channel B. We closed the wholesale channel because revenue was flat, no real opportunity. Mm-hmm. Gross profit margin and contribution margin was minimal. While it was positive, not nearly as much as channels A and B, A and C.
Right.
So we put that money in growing and putting attention back on revenue in his primary channel, which was his direct sales. And today, 3.5-4 years later, his company is still in business. He's successful and profitable. He's paid back all of his debt. And he would look at that. If you were to talk to him, he would say that that was the pivotal point. And what I'm talking about is understanding what's going on in the business, not just looking at a set of financial statements.
So it's really a powerful strategic tool that I think, unfortunately, particularly first-time entrepreneurs, undervalue and just don't get how it can be a powerful tool for them. In part, maybe because of how the universities teach it, right? It's a fairly complex subject to understand. How do the three financial statements all flow together? And it's not a whole lot of fun when you learn it for the first time. But the fun is when you see, wow, this, you know, you can look at the three channels and see which area should I grow in. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. I'll give another real quick example. I do some investing. You were, I believe, one of the founding members of the Olympus Angel Group. I'm in the Park City Angel Group.
Yes.
And have invested through my firm in a number of startup companies. And one of the things I always look at is accounts payable. So you sell stuff to your customers and they owe you money. And how many days is it taking for you to get this paid? And when I see a kind of a blip out of the way, you know, sometimes I'll call the CEO and say, hey, what's going on? And I've done this several times. And in one case, the entrepreneur had a great answer for me, right? They had tried a new channel. It was a corporate channel. And those guys take longer to pay. And you know what? It was becoming a larger percent of the business. So that's a great answer. Another time I called an entrepreneur, he's like, well, what do you mean my accounts payable? What does that mean? And that's not the good answer, right? So as an investor, you feel very uncomfortable with that when that happens. Why do you think here we are, you know, really 20 years, a quarter of a century in to really the small company boom and where younger people can start a company. Why do you think a quarter of a century later, people still really don't understand the power of good financial and business information?
It's a great question, Doug. And unfortunately, I think I have to look back on my profession, accounting, right? I'm a CPA. While I don't use my certified public accounting license in terms of what I do today, and it comes down to what we're taught and sort of how we practice. But our profession hasn't, I think, stepped up generally and across the board and recognized that the value is not in just preparing a set of financial statements. The value is about information, what's going on in my business. In school, we're still taught profit and loss, balance sheet, statement of cash flows. And there's good information to be had there. From our perspective, generating that information accurately and timely means that we've built a foundation from which we can pull other information. But you have to take that financial information, break it out into the segments, the channels, whatever it is that makes sense, and then you have to combine non-financial operating information to come up with the real metrics that make sense for a given business and for it to understand.
Now, you were the president of the local, I think it's the Utah chapter for CPAs. I forget the organization's name.
Utah Association of CPAs.
If that's about as close as it's well named. I can paraphrase it and get close. was that one of the things that during your tenure you tried to help the profession with?
Yeah, it's one of the things that, frankly, they're probably all tired of hearing me say. I had sort of a three-pronged approach or three pillars to what I was trying to do last year. Number one was competency, and this comes in that area. Competency to know what's going on and to provide something that's of value to your client. Now, that client might be your employer when you're the CFO or controller. It might be a client like we have clients where we're an outsourced CFO. It might be you're a CPA and you're helping with taxes and they're looking to you for that strategic guidance and advice. And unfortunately, too many accountants still believe they delivered a set of financial statements, they're done. And the reality, that's not true. In today's world, it moves so fast that a set of financial statements 10, 15, 20 days after the end of the month, you've now blown 2 months before you can react to whatever information you get. Whereas daily dashboards of key metrics about a business, I can respond today and I've only lost 1 day. Or I might get a trend and I might see it over the period of a week. And instead of being 6 weeks out, I can respond to that and react immediately today.
You know, and that's good advice for listeners that might be running a company is the daily dashboard. It's another thing I talk to entrepreneurs about. And it's not unusual for entrepreneurs initially not to really know. They might know, hey, here's the three or four kind of key things that I look at, which is great. And maybe that's all your dashboard has to be. But if you can't get the key metrics for running your business on one piece of paper, you probably don't understand your business well enough. And so there's a lot of value in just thinking through, what is that daily dashboard? What information do I need to make better decisions?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of the things, a lot of companies will come to us and they'll say, well, we need you to help us with a budget and we need you to help us raise capital and we need you to help you to do all these things. And the first thing I always say is, let's talk about your strategy. What is it you're trying to do? Frankly, a budget or forecast is nothing more than a strategy in an Excel spreadsheet.
Sure.
So the key drivers that drive that strategy, the things that we have to do, the number of leads that we have to bring in, how many demos we have to give, what kind of closing rate we have to have, those are all really key drivers to make this business work.
And you can look at those and you can break them down and say, who on your team, if it's close rate, let's say you've got salesmen, who's got the best close rate? And you can look at that and you can see somebody, you know, maybe has a dip and maybe something's going on in their personal life and they need to take some time off to deal with it. But you can see those things quickly and help keep them from becoming a bigger issue.
Yeah, and on the dashboard, it's really important, I think, to look at it first on a macro basis and really see overall what your business is doing. But just like the financial statements in the three channels, you also need to drill down into that and have behind that the information, like you said, by, say, individual rep or territory or company or product type or whatever it happens to be. I mean, we've seen so many times that the same thing that happened with that company I told you about earlier happens within a sales group, mm-hmm. right? Everything looks like it's okay, but you see one or two salespeople whose sales are really off. We also see on a macro basis that you'll see things happening. And then when we dig into it, we find out, well, the reason why sales are down is there's a product problem. There's a technology issue. There's a glitch out there in the last release. And it's not making it sort of up to the top management mm-hmm. team. But the salespeople are down here, and they're not being able to make sales because there's a problem.
So I think us chatting, there may be some folks out there thinking, you know, I've got somebody I'm working with now that's good tactically. And really what we're talking about is strategic. My business is the wealth management business. And I can tell you in the accounting world, particularly when you're dealing with folks that are helping families, accountants that are helping families, there's a lot of folks, accountants, that are very good tactically. Very fewer accountants that are comfortable in or want to do some of this strategic work. You know, in families, you know, in 3 years, how do you change the tax situation for a family? A lot of accountants don't want to talk about that. So for a business owner that is hearing this and is saying, yeah, this is what I want, how do they find a CFO? How do they find somebody, a financial person to help them that is strategic?
You know, I mean, that comes down to the interview and doing your research and finding out.
You help companies
we
find.
Do.
And in fact,
we do.
It's one of the things I want to come back to later. But as a company grows, you know, you'll tell them, hey, you know, you've outgrown us. You need a full-time CFO now. You did that with my company.
Yes.
Helped me find a great person. What are those things that you're looking for when you help them find a good CFO?
What I'm really looking for is someone who isn't so focused on accounting that that's all they see. I need somebody. I always say that a good CFO has to understand more about the company than anyone else in the company. They have to understand operations intimately. They need to have a partnership with your COO, with the salesperson, the chief marketing officer. They really need to be able to work together and understand what's happening. Otherwise, it's impossible for the CFO to give that broad level advice and the detailed advice and be the CEO's strategic partner.
And it seems like it would be a much more rewarding job done that way. Is that what you enjoy when you're putting on the CFO hat?
You know what? If it were all about accounting, I would have been out of this business a long time ago, Doug. It's what I love about this is I can sit in a meeting with the management team. We can have a great discussion about strategy, a lot of push and pull. Sometimes the volume raises quite a bit as we disagree on what we need to have. But you come out of that with a really clear understanding. Now I can go out and really implement that in the accounting system and make it all work, make sure we're capturing the right information. And that leads me to one of the other things that we really find far too frequently, and that is the people who are doing the accounting in many cases aren't the right people, or they haven't properly been trained, or they don't really know what they're supposed to do. And that sort of stems in some cases from the fact that procedures in businesses, they just happen. There's no design to it. There's no review of it. There's no making sure we've got proper controls protecting both information and assets. And that's one of the things that we do and we think is critically important. We come into companies and we find also that they're using 30 Excel spreadsheets to do transaction processing. The problem with that is in today's world, technology is so affordable and ubiquitous that you can get web-based technologies and apps and other programs that will work together, where most of this work that is now being done in Excel spreadsheets can be done in a program, in an app. It can be integrated into your back-end accounting system, and you have access to it. The problem with Excel spreadsheets is they're on somebody's computer, and nobody else has – there's no transparency. No one has access to it. In addition to the fact that there was a recent study of Fortune 500 companies, and 40-something percent of all the Excel spreadsheets they audited had fatal flaws, and nobody knew it. And I will tell you my experience.
And the problem with that is if that audit comes and you're the guy that's created the Excel spreadsheet, your job's on the line.
Exactly.
Right? You buy a SaaS software and there's a flaw in there. Well, maybe you change vendors, but your job's probably not on
right.
the line. So yeah. I'm a huge fan of Excel. You and I, much of the work we did together was Excel forecasting. You're one of the top 10 Excel programmers that I know. I love Excel, but it does have its limits, and I think that's good advice. And you know, I think most people would be surprised to find out they're probably spending more in man hours than they would be to use a professional app or cloud-based service So they're spending more to get less, and they're taking bigger risks. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense. So let's talk about how you got into this business. I believe 1996 is really when you started to offer services on an outsourced basis.
That's correct.
How did that come to be?
It's not the typical entrepreneur's path and story, right? I didn't see a great opportunity and decide I was going to start a business to meet that challenge. What happened is, in reality, in 1994, my wife was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And 13 months later, our son, youngest child, was diagnosed with a non-treatable terminal illness. And, you know, not to mention that sort of threw the family into a tailspin.
Sure.
I was running a business at the time, a rental business, and that's why I had the experience that you wanted to hire me.
Right.
And I went to my partner and said, I'm out. I've got to have time for the family. So we sold the business, and in December of 1995, I started consulting because I needed you know, time with my family and flexibility. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting story because I started that. I got two or three clients. And it wasn't until later the next year, I was working with a client where I had actually been the CFO and then the CEO before, and we sold the business, franchising business. I was working with one of the regional franchisees who called me up and said, I want to buy it back. So he said, would you consult me? And since I knew the business well, I said, sure, it's what I'm doing. And in the middle of that process of doing due diligence to buy that company back, we were in Little America Hotel here in downtown Salt Lake. It was about 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the evening. And he said, Kent, if we close this deal, I need a CFO, but I can't afford you full time. Would you do it part time for me? And frankly, I'd never thought about it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, sure, I'm consulting. I could make that work. And then I'm driving home before 215 was finished up here on the east side, going along Wasatch. I looked out over the valley and I saw these thousands of lights. And I said, there are 10,000 businesses out there that could use a part-time CFO. This is a great idea. And Doug, that was the genesis of Advanced CFO Solutions.
And was that, have you pretty much stayed on that path then? So it's really the outsourced CFO package that has been your vision over the last, it sounds like, almost 20 years.
Almost
now.
20 years. Yeah, it that is very much the core of what we do. But, you know, like every other entrepreneur, we've had to reinvent ourselves. And we're going through that again right now. It seems like about every 10 years, technology changes in the business dictate that what you've done in the past isn't going to work. It isn't what the companies need. So the advent of all of this technology, web-based applications, programs that you can get for $5 per user per month that do amazing things,
right,
that's fairly recent. Now we have to take all of that and integrate it back in to the systems we have so that we have much better information, it's automated, and it's much faster and easier to get to.
And how do you keep on top of that? Is there a system? You talked about procedures earlier. Do you guys have a group whose job is, let's look at the upcoming technology, what we should be doing? Does it get introduced primarily by existing clients? Or how do you stay top of game on that?
The reality for us to be valuable, we can't wait for the clients to say, hey, what about this little thing I saw? We really need to be on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons, frankly, why I've maintained my membership in the Utah Association of CPAs and my CPA license current. That forces me to take 40 hours a year of continuing education, and I subscribe to those areas. I subscribe to three or four daily newsletters.
Practice management, stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Technology is one, practice management, even some of the tax. I don't do taxes, Doug. I'm not good at it. I've never really focused on it. I don't even do my own. But my clients expect me to understand enough about tax law that I can advise them on what needs to be done, help them find a good CPA or tax attorney.
Right.
So I review those every single day. I'm reviewing those kind of articles, looking about what's happening there. Then I see something that I'm interested in, and then I will schedule a continuing education class that I will take, maybe 4 to 8 hours, that will focus on that subject so I can get really good at it. I also go to very broad update seminars or webinars about everything going on. For example, accounting principles, right? All of the new regulations that are coming out about revenue recognition or things that are changing. I go to those so I can get a broad view of what's happening out there, but I don't get into the details because, frankly, if I don't have any clients who are in oil and gas, I don't need to know all of the oil and gas specific accounting rules. And I'm not going to spend my time learning them and being an expert at them. you have to know what you don't know. You have to know what you're good at, and you have to be willing to say, I need help.
Well, it's like any company too, right? You got to stay up on the current trends so that you can connect the dots.
Exactly.
And say, okay, where does this firm need to be in 5 or 10 years so that you continue to be the top service provider in your area? You mentioned oil and gas earlier. You know, I would think one of the challenges in your business is you do serve companies across a wide spectrum of industry, and as you alluded to, each has slightly different accounting rules. How do you do that? Do you have partners that specialize in different areas, or how do you make sure that you have expertise in that broad range of industries?
Good question. We do have partners, but more importantly, there are 30 of us at Advanced CFO, and all of our consultants have 15 to 30 years of experience. So there aren't many industries we haven't had some experience in. So if we get a client who's looking for, who is in this specific industry, then the first thing we do is match them up with one of the consultants who has industry expertise. That's number one. Number two is availability, the time available to dig in and get the job done for them and do it right. The other thing I've learned, I've been the CFO of 80 different companies over the course of my career. Sounds like a bad case of ADHD, I know. But when they're part-time, you can do that. But I've learned that 80% of what I do is the same company to company to company. Get a good base of solid financial information. Make sure we're generating financial statements correctly. Look at what the key drivers are in this business. Help understand the strategy. Set the procedures. Make a partnership with all of the operating folks in the business and make sure we're capturing information correctly. On top of that, the other 20% is sort of industry and company specific. And a good CFO will dig in and figure that out.
And so over time, you may go in, you know what you don't know, maybe have somebody else help you with that initially.
Absolutely.
But over time, you take over that area of expertise.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. KSL Radio did an interview with you, or they did a report where they had talked to you ahead of time. It was a brief report, like a couple minutes, in 2012. And one of the things the reporter mentioned is that your team's paid on performance, which I think is probably pretty unusual in your field for accountants in particular. How did you come up with the idea that you wanted to do that? And then how well received is that from your team?
Very well received by clients. They love it. Not always well received by traditional accountants. But we are, as a profession, pretty conservative, and we are risk adverse. So what that tells you is that our team are a bit more entrepreneurial than—
Which is a good match for your clients.
It's absolutely right. A great match for our clients. And I'll tell you the reason why I did it. You know, I mean, from a cash flow perspective, it's great because I don't pay until we get paid. But that wasn't really my reasoning. I wasn't looking at my own cash flow saying this is really important to me. What I was looking at is how do I match up the interests of the client, Advanced CFO Solutions, and the consultant so that we're all aligned to accomplish the same things. The consultant wants to do the work. They want to do a good job, and they want to be paid. Advanced CFO wants to maintain a great relationship with that client because most of our new business comes from referrals from existing and prior clients.
Right.
The client wants their work done, and they want it done well and on time. And the only way I could find to really line that up is to pay the consultant based on what they actually perform and making sure that the client is happy. And frankly, we never have a problem being paid when we do superb work. Our clients are more than happy to pay because they don't want to lose us. If the client isn't paying, it's one of my key metrics that I'm watching.
Right.
If they're not paying, the reason is typically they weren't satisfied and they haven't bothered to tell me or they haven't felt comfortable telling me.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I think, as I said, it's unusual in the industry. And sometimes having an unusual strategy can help. As you say, it aligns everything. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. Another interview that I read as part of our research, the reporter talked about your one-strike rule. What is your one-strike rule?
I have one-strike rule with respect to matters of honesty, and that is if someone is dishonest one time, I won't give them a second shot. I can't. Our business is all about trust. Our relationship with our clients is 100% about trust, and I have to have that kind of relationship with my consultants. Frankly, I have the one strike rule with clients as well.
I was going to ask if you've seen it, unfortunately, with clients as well.
I have, unfortunately. We've fired or resigned from several clients as a result of that specific item. Ask me to walk the line on ethics, and we're done. I can't do that. Reputation is the only thing that we have, and our reputation is it's worth more than anything else that we have. So that's the reason for the one strike rule. And while I believe in redemption and that people can change, they're going to have to do it at somewhere
with
else. Somewhere,
company, with somebody else.
Not at my company.
Exactly. Good. Speaking of ethics, you have a LinkedIn profile. You have like 3,000 followers to what you publish on your LinkedIn. Earlier this summer, you did an article about what is ethical behavior. And I think you made a really good point there, and it's worth talking about because for any business, they have that issue. And your main point was, oftentimes when you confront somebody, if you see something that you think is unethical, you're surprised that the other person is viewing it as, no, that's not unethical, and here's why. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a little bit indicative of society, right? I mean, go to the highest levels of government in the United States, and I'm not going to pick on any particular party. It doesn't matter because it happens on both sides. But you see it in Congress. You see the president. You see others who and business executives who do bad things. They do clearly unethical things, and then they vehemently deny it.
Well, and you and I hear it, and we think, what were they thinking?
Exactly.
Why would somebody do that?
Exactly.
It's so clear to us on the other side. Why do you think it's so blurry and apparently confusing to them?
Well, I don't know if it's just pride. I don't know if it's selfishness and greed or if it's a combination of those and other things and maybe jealousy and watching what other people are doing. But one of our presidents, after being impeached, and you'll probably know who I'm referring to, when it finally all came down to it and he talked about the situation, he said something I think is very telling. And he said, unfortunately, I did it because I could, and it's the worst possible reason for doing something.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about your no-strike rule, right? I mean, the Bible tells us don't fight temptation, run from temptation. And I think that's the problem is people flirt with it, think they can control it. And I think the best advice is to have a one-strike rule or, my rule is to run from it. Don't try to confront it, just run from it. And thinking about it ahead of time so that when you're in that situation, you're just going to turn your back and you're just going to leave the situation and you're not going to let yourself get sucked into it, because once you're part of it, it can very quickly become a slippery slope.
Absolutely. It takes me back to an early defining moment in my career. I was at the age of 29, I was made the CFO of a publicly traded company in Los Angeles. The company I was working for was acquired. The treasurer resigned, he got older and he had some health problems and it was unexpected. I was the only person in the company who had public accounting background and really enough experience. Not that at 29 I was by any stretch of the imagination prepared to be the CFO of a publicly traded company. Probably wouldn't happen in today's world with the oversight the way it is. But after a year and a half there, we were growing by acquisition. The company that I had worked for had been acquired as well as two others. We were pulling them together. And my boss was also a CPA, had been in the past in his career. He was traveling in Europe and in the Middle East, and it was time for the 10-Q to be issued, the quarterly reports to the SEC. And he was supposed to be home about a week before we issued, and we would always sit down and go through the reports and everything together. And he called, he sent me a message and said that he was going to be delayed. He was going to spend some time in New York and a few other places on his way, and he wouldn't be home until the day before. Well, what had happened, just to give a little background, the company was going to show its first quarterly loss in 20 years. And that's not good for a publicly traded company, especially if the investors aren't informed a little [S2] Right. [S1] Bit in advance about what's going on. Well, my boss was typically optimistic, as many CEOs and entrepreneurs are, about what's going on in the future and how things will turn around. I had everything prepared for him well in advance, and we were going to show it was a small loss, and there was a good reason for it. And in the days before pro forma analysis that CFOs do all day long, I had already done. And I said, now, if everything had been exactly as we planned with this merger and the integration of IT and the other departments, and without these extra expenses, this is what our profit would have been. But we're not going to have a profit because all of this synergy, all of the bringing the companies together hadn't happened as quickly as we expected, and it had cost more. So when he got back in, it was the night before the 10-Qs were due. It was about 8 o'clock. He called me from one of his stopovers on an airplane and said, stay late if you will, because I want to review those financial statements with you before tomorrow. So I stayed. It was about 7:30 or 8 o'clock. He came in. I laid it out for him. He looked at him, and he goes, well, all I can tell you is we've got to make an adjustment to make that a profit. And I said, what do you mean? I guess I was naive. I was only I was 31 at the time. But I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know what I mean. Inventories are pretty much a guess anyway. We can just put a number there, and that will increase us to a profit. And I said, we can't do that.
Right.
We do cycle counts every 10 days. We do cycle counts of our inventory. The auditors have bought off on it. There's no way we can justify that kind of an adjustment. He goes, look, we're both CPAs. We know this. You know this game. Get in there and make it happen. And then he walked out of my office. So I called up my wife and I said, well, I guess this is the end. He's going to fire me now. She says, what do you mean? And I said, well, I explained the story. And she says, well, just come home. So I walked into his office. I laid it on his desk and I said, if you want to make an adjustment, you make the adjustment. I'm not signing the 10-Q. And I walked out. As he said a few things about my genealogy and some other things. And so I left, and I didn't come in the next morning until 10 o'clock because the auditors were to be there at 10:30, and I didn't want to have any confrontation.
Right.
And so the auditors came. The company showed a loss. The stock took a hit. And by the way, he had told – the reason that he was adamant about it is he had told – 2 days before he had met with analysts in New York and told them we were going to have a profit. But he didn't bother to call me and check with what was going on. Anyway, to make a long story short, that was a very difficult decision.
Yeah, it was.
I will guarantee you that I thought multiple times about whether I was going to do what he wanted or not do what he wanted. And it would have been really easy to justify and say, hey, look, I've only been here for 2 years. We just had our fourth child. We're in Los Angeles. I didn't have a great network there because my entire career prior to that was in Utah. I was building it, but I didn't know a lot of people. Great big mortgage on this house that cost three times what my house in Utah did. I mean, there were a lot of reasons to rationalize that decision. But at the end of the day, the right decision was to say no. Ultimately, I resigned. We worked out a deal. I lost my job, and I came back to Utah. And it was hard. I mean, there was not a lack of suffering from making that decision because I became persona non grata at the company after that. He couldn't fire me, but he made my job miserable. And so all the time when you do the right thing, it isn't all, you know.
You know, and that's an important point, right? Entrepreneurs, you know, we tell our kids, do the right thing. And unfortunately, people think, well, I do the right things, things are going to turn out. Well, that I have found that to be true in my life as well. But it can take a couple years for things to work out okay, and you can go through some pain, and that's when you find out what your values are.
Exactly.
Is when it's not easy to do the right thing. When it's easy to do the right thing, well, you don't have to dig into your core. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. So, you know, one of the things to me, Kent, that's really interesting about your model, and I think ties into values as well, is as your companies grow and as they need more and more of your services and as the billings are increasing and they become a more profitable client, it's right at that point that you go to them like you did to me and say, hey, in my case, hey, Doug, you know, you're big enough now, your company's succeeding. You need a full-time CFO. And it's one of the things that makes your growth so impressive is because these larger clients that would provide that base, you're saying, hey, it's time for us to transition away. Why is that an important part of your model that there's a time where you separate as a company succeeds.
It's really simple. It's the right thing for the client. It's absolutely what they need. And, you know, I've watched this happen both with competitors of mine and with other people doing similar things where they just hold on, and it turns out to be detrimental to the client. And that our core philosophy is always always make a decision that's right for the client, not right for us. And you talk about how you make sort of those tough decisions and you pay for it for a while. But here's what's happened is that those clients where that has happened inevitably end up doing one of two things, either making a lot of referrals to others because they like our work and they refer people into us, or a serial entrepreneur sold that business and then he'll be on to another one. And the first telephone calls he makes is to me and said, come on, we've got another one. Let's go do this deal. Yeah. And I've got a lot of examples of that. One of my favorite is Rick Alden at Skull Candy. I met Rick in his home in 2003. He was running Skull Candy out of his house in his garage. And Rick wouldn't mind me telling the story because I've told it a million times. But we walked in and I said, you know, Rick, well, let's look at your financial statements. And he pops open his laptop computer. He goes to Quicken. He shows me the Rick and Holly Alden Zions Bank account, and he said, there you go. And that's really pretty typical. And I said, okay, well, first thing we're going to do is get you a set of financial statements for the company and not intermingle personal funds. And, you know, and Skull Candy became a great client. I was up there two and a half days a week working a lot. We had a controller up there working with them.
It had to be really fun work. I mean, they were just taking over the industry. They're online to do an IPO. They did an IPO. So not only does he become a bigger client, but he's a really fun client too.
Yeah, and Rick became a great friend. Rick was one of those CEOs who would call me at 10:30 at night with a great idea, and we would spend 2 hours talking on the phone. And that's when you know you're the strategic partner. They call with those kind of phone calls and have those discussions. But in the middle of 2008, we were growing to $33 million in revenue, growing 300% a year. And I'd been telling Rick and Jeremy Andrus, who was the COO there, for 6 months, we need to get a CFO. We really need to get a CFO. And they were so busy growing, they didn't have time to think about it. So I went and scoured my network. I got two great candidates, interviewed them, walked into Rick's office one day. And by the way, it was Rick and Jeremy's office because they worked on one folding table. I laid down the resumes and I said, at the end of the month, I resign. One of these two guys is my replacement. You better get interviewing him. And Rick stops. He looks up at me and he goes, wait, you're my rent-a-foe. That was my title. You can't quit. And I said, Rick, I have to. This is the right thing for the company. Yeah. And it wasn't quitting because I didn't want to be there. Like you said, they were my most lucrative client. They were the largest and growing, and there was a lot of opportunity. But it wasn't
great
right
guys,
for them.
Fun.
Yeah, fun work with. Yep. It wasn't right for them. And the decision had to be, what's best for them.
And I imagine that happens more often than not, that you really have to convince the CEO it's time. I mean, that was my case when we had that conversation. It was, I really don't want to take the time to do this. I want to focus on what I'm focusing on. But you're right. You know, 6 months later, after transition was in place, I had somebody in my office. In my case, it was a gentleman named Bob Gerber.
Yep.
He was number two in finance at Joann Fabrics, which was a publicly held company at the time. So he was a great match for us. But before we had Bob on board, I'm like, oh, this is a distraction. I really don't want to spend the time. But you're right. Then you do sing the praises of your company because you see it. Let me ask you about, you know, your business is very time intensive. What you're selling is your advice, your time, your experience. Have you thought about how do we leverage that? Is there a way to maybe build some software tools that can help companies? You mentioned some of the cloud platform tools. Have you guys developed any that kind of incorporate your best practices?
Yeah, as I was saying before, you go through these reiterations of reinventing your company, and we're in that one right now. We've developed we call it Clarity Accounting. It's a web-based system. QuickBooks is the back end to start with, but we'll eventually be able to hook into any accounting system that the client happens to be using. And a number of third-party and other technologies, some of the technology we've built, but most of it we've brought together because there's so much out there that is completely web-based. It automates the entire process, and we can do the accounting from start to finish, and our clients don't even need to have a bookkeeper on staff. We literally can do everything, and it's all web-based. It's available 24/7. Dashboards are included. We do 13-week cash flow forecasting for our small clients because one of the things especially as they're growing, the companies aren't thinking about is, what about my cash flow 3 months from now?
Right. They better be thinking about that.
Yeah, they better be. We recently started work with a client, a $20-plus million company. They opened an office in Denver to expand their business and had no budget whatsoever and no expectation about what would happen, only thinking that there was plenty of revenue to be had and that they would be fine. And they've met their revenue goals every single month and, in fact, exceeded them. What they didn't think about was, we have to buy inventory, and then we have to sell that inventory, and then we have to wait to get paid. We call it the operating cycle, from the day you pay for your inventory to the day you sell it. And
sometimes the better you do, the more cash you use.
It's exactly right. It's what happened in their case. In March or February, their accountant told them that they needed $400,000 on the line of credit to meet all of their bills and obligations, and no one was expecting that. And that surprise prompted them to call us, and we went in and helped them. And there were a few things that they needed help with on solidifying their financial systems. But more than anything else, they needed a good cash flow forecast so that they could look out and see 3 to 6 months from now. And if it's going to be red, now we have time to deal with it.
Right.
Versus, we have to make payroll and make all these payments next week.
Your bank doesn't want that phone call.
No, the bank does not want that phone call. So we help them avoid that.
You know, speaking of raising capital, I mentioned in the open you've helped companies raise, about 200 companies raise over $1 billion in aggregate. And most people think of investment bankers as folks that help them raise capital. It's really not what you do.
No.
But yet you play a critical role in that. How did that part of your business come to be, where you're helping people, you're advising people on how to raise capital?
It came to be, again, as you're listening to and talking to clients and potential clients, you find out what their real needs are. And in Utah, in 1997, 98, 99, which is just when I had started this business, technology started to boom. You remember the dot-com boom and bust and everything. Well, we were right in the heat of that. And investors started to – actually, they started to have investment funds in Utah. Vspring was one of the early ones. Wasatch Venture Fund, now Epic, was in place then. And as those private equity and venture capital groups found out about us, they loved the model because their clients really needed good financial advice, but they didn't want them to hire full-time CFOs and spend all that money because it was their money.
Right.
So they started bringing us into these clients and getting us involved. And again, we figured out we needed to get some expertise on how to raise capital. So we started doing that. We started working with them and doing the due diligence, helping them get prepared, do their forecasts, and understand what's going on with their business. In that process, we've developed relationships with all of the private equity and venture capital groups in Utah, many out of state. And most of the individuals and groups that do angel investment as well. So it's a process of meeting our clients' need and then figuring out how to get competent in that area and helping them.
It sounds like almost any other company, right? I mean, the need arose. It may not have been something in 96 when you're looking out over the valley of 10,000, 100,000 companies that need the services that you thought of. But as you got into it, you saw the need for it. And so you developed an expertise in there.
Exactly.
The challenge with most investment bankers when you use somebody to help you raise capital is typically the model is they're going to charge you a percent of the capital that you raise. And your model really is an hourly rate. I'm guessing you're probably an hourly rate, whether you're advising somebody on raising capital or advising them on strategy for their next area or pricing for their products. Is that right?
Yeah, it actually is morphed from an hourly rate to a fixed fee.
Kind of a retainer.
Yeah. So okay. We work on a fixed fee retainer that doesn't change. So and this is one of the things, again, clients told me this, that this is what they wanted. They hated to have an hourly rate, and they never quite knew what it was going to be at the end of the month. There are some other professions, I won't mention them right here, but they do that, and it frustrates a lot of people.
Sure.
So we looked at it and said, look, while still we're time intensive, and what we offer is our time and our expertise, and we base it based on a number of hours, but we do the estimate, and then we take the risk. If it goes over that, you still get billed at the fixed fee amount. If you ask for more, then we'll talk about it, and at some point in time raise the retainer up, but it's all based on that. On that methodology. So if we're helping someone raise capital, first of all, we're not sort of promising them they're going to get the capital. We're helping them get ready. If we have contacts that we can introduce them to, we'll introduce them to. And that's a balancing act, as you can appreciate, Doug, because I'll have somebody who comes to me that wants to raise capital, and if their profile of their company doesn't meet any of the investors that I know, I'm not going to make the introduction. Yeah. It would be a mistake. It wouldn't help them at all because they would be told no, and it would hurt my reputation.
Make it harder for you the next time.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've got to be very careful about filtering and knowing exactly what each investor wants to look at before I offer the opportunity.
Sure. If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. You know, one of the things you do in your role is as you say, you know, Rick Alden would call you up at night with different, hey, what do you think of this idea or that idea? So you're helping entrepreneurs think through ideas, strategize, you know, and unfortunately the reality is, I don't know, nationwide it's 80% of new companies fail. So you've probably helped companies, unfortunately, that didn't survive. As you're talking to the entrepreneur and it's becoming clear, hey, you know what, this isn't going to work. That's a hard thing for a CEO to face. What kind of advice do you give them on facing that difficult challenge?
It's a great point, and you're right. Many companies fail. Fortunately, 80% of our clients have not failed.
That's a good reason right there to consider using your firm.
Many times people will come to me and say they want to raise capital because they think that's the way to build their business. The reality is less than 10% of all the companies that start up will raise any outside capital at all. So you have to be honest and give them a straight, clear view of what's really out there. But what I try to do is I start from the beginning, and that is, tell me, what do you want to do with your business? Is it a business you want to hold for 30 years and pass on to your children? Is it a business you want to build and sell? What is your ultimate goal? What's the end game in that? And if it's a business you want to hold forever, outside capital is not a good idea, because by bringing in outside investors, they're typically going to have a trigger that says that within a certain time frame, you have to cash me out. And if the business, whether it's doing well or not so well, you probably won't have the capital, which means you just agreed to sell your business. So I try to help educate the entrepreneur about what it means to get capital and talk about other alternatives. There are lots of loan programs, SBA programs. Salt Lake County, Utah County, Davis County, Salt Lake City all have loan programs, mm-hmm. revolving programs that can help companies get started. There are a number of places to go to get some startup capital to help them through the process. And we try to help them know what is the right way to go. And when you talk about 80% of the companies failing, if you go and dig into that in terms of the surveys, what you find is there are three primary reasons. Number one, it says management. And what that really means is that they didn't know everything, right? They didn't surround themselves with advisors who knew what they didn't know or people who could help them. So they tried to go in knowing a technology but knowing nothing about finance, legal, marketing, sales, and they tried to make a business work on the basis of a great technology. Probably going to fail. So that's number one. Number two is lack of proper capitalization. It means they didn't raise enough money or have enough money available to make the business work. What I've learned over the years is it's not that they couldn't raise the money. It's they didn't know how to estimate how much they needed. And entrepreneurs are infamously optimistic that we're going to get this much revenue in this period of time, and this will happen, and this will happen.
It takes a lot of optimism to be an entrepreneur. It really, it's a tough path.
It really does. The reality is that probably less than 5% of all the initial business plans generated by entrepreneurs actually come to fruition. And so you have to take a step back and look at it and say, so what if that doesn't happen? Here's a key driver that you're making that makes an assumption, and if I double that, look what that does to your cash flow. And the reality, Doug, you and I talked about this when we were working together. The only thing I know about a forecast is it's wrong. I've never made one that 5 years
right.
later was perfect.
Sure.
But the value of a good forecast is to be able to do the what-if analysis and say, all right, now, I don't know all the assumptions, but if we make this assumption, what if it changes? What does that do? And sometimes, in the case of Skullcandy, the assumptions kept being, oh, we've got to grow faster than that, right? And so the challenge there was still a cash flow challenge, not because we weren't generating revenue, but because we were generating so much inventory and receivables, somehow we had to bridge that gap. And so whether it's growing faster than expected or slower than expected, You need to understand what's going on and plan and prepare for it. And that's reason number two, lack of capitalization, mm-hmm. not proper preparation. And then if you don't have a good set of financial statements and dashboards to tell you what's going on, you get the news from your CPA or your accountant a week or two before you run out of cash that you can't make payroll. And you're never going to get the money from a bank then. It's too late.
Well, and you're going to start losing your team. All kinds of bad things happen.
Right.
You know, when I talk to entrepreneurs that are facing a difficult situation and they're like, look, this may not work. You know, and they're starting to face this. We may be shutting down. One of the things I tell them is, you know, be as open and transparent with everybody. Let all your investors know.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a right way to fail and there's a wrong way to fail. And so if you're facing that, give a lot of thought to what's the right way to face this. Because certainly in the Bay Area and more so now in Utah than 20 years ago, if you don't succeed in your first venture but you fail the right way, your investors are going to give you a shot at a couple more. Frankly, you're going to be a lot more valuable to your investors as with your next startup than a first-time entrepreneur because of everything that you've learned. But really think through what's the right way to fail. I want to transition now and kind of talk about your personal journey. So you've been doing this for 20 years. In the next couple of years, you're going to start to transition out of your firm. How do you think about that, and how have you prepared your team for Advanced CFO Solutions when there's a day that Kent Thomas isn't coming into the office every day?
It's a very relevant point to us right now because you're right. So just about 2 years ago, I brought in three new partners. They've purchased 70% of the company. I'm committed to be around for at least another 2 or 3 years and help them in that process. My biggest concern when we made the transition or started the transition was that I was personally responsible for about 80% of all the new business coming in. And that's certainly not sustainable.
Right.
If I walk away, that makes a real problem. But we've got that now below 50%. And they're really stepping up and doing a great job. I've transitioned the managing partner role to Dave Chase. He's doing a wonderful job with that. And so I'm really spending my time now doing more mentoring than I am personal service. I've got three clients that I work with. A lot of fun. Still love what I do every day. But I spend a lot of time mentoring and meeting with the partners and the other consultants. We've hired a full-time business development person, Matt Castleberry, and he's doing a great job just helping us manage the deals. The reality is that Dave and JB and Casey and I, when a lead comes in, if I'm helping a client in a banking transaction, it's probably going to be 3 days before I get back to them. And that's not a great way to handle leads and the sales process. So Matt makes sure that we're on top of it, that we meet with them, that we get proposals out and we're responsive. So those sort of three things have really made a huge difference. In fact, I just got back from 3 weeks in Africa. And
I was going to ask you about that because we tried to book this earlier, this interview with you, and you were on a safari in Africa.
Yes.
So I was going to ask you about that trip. Let's finish with this question, and then we'll.
But I've never been away for 3 weeks before since I started this business.
Wow.
I've never been able to take that time off, and I can now. And the funnest part is you talk about metrics, right, and dashboards. I'm in Africa, and a week, and I'm checking email every day because it's just what I do. My wife fortunately deals with that. And
gives you the hour a day you need to
exactly.
do it.
Exactly.
Close supported. The laptop, put it away.
That's right, as long as I unplug. But I'm looking at the metrics on leads that came in, and I look at the 5 or 6 leads that came in the week prior. I was only responsible for one, and that was a celebration for me.
Right.
Now, you know, some entrepreneurs might look at that and say, oh, this is my baby. I can't stand to let it go. But for me, that's great. Because what I want is I want Advanced CFO to continue. These are great partners I've got. We've got some incredible CFOs who've been CFOs of huge companies and small companies, and they've raised capital and done all the great things. But you know, I've got to figure out a succession plan that doesn't have Kent Thomas in it, and it's working. So I'm excited.
It's hard to do that. And my last question before I ask you a little bit more about Africa. Is what do you see as the future for Advanced CFO Solutions? Where do you hope the company is 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
You know, that depends on what the partners want to do. We could expand this beyond Utah. In fact, we're looking at a geographic expansion right now. We're really careful about that. Frankly, there are still thousands of companies in Utah that aren't utilizing our services that could. And most of that is because they don't know that we're there. So doing a better job of getting the word out and marketing is an important thing for us to do. But I'll tell you where I really think we're going, and that is the Clarity accounting system that we've set up, I think will become a platform that can be licensed out, that a CFO in a publicly traded or a private company can take that platform, plug it in, get access to all the information, and then use that in their system, not with us doing the accounting. It's the reporting structure that we've put together and the way we've integrated all these systems together. And that's where I think 5 years from now, where we really have the big win.
Nice, nice. You know, you and I are alike in many ways. When I go on vacation, unfortunately, I check my email and my wife has the 1 hour rule. Okay, you can work for an hour, but at the end of it, you got to put away the computer. And when Ross, our producer of this show, reached out to try to book you and I heard you were in Africa, my first thought was his wife's trying to get him away from Wi-Fi. But apparently, even in Africa, you don't get away from Wi-Fi. That's great. So you were able to take 3 weeks?
Yes.
And what was your favorite part of being in Africa?
It was incredible. We were in Tanzania and Kenya, and everybody, when we were going, says, oh, aren't you afraid of Ebola? Well, that's on the other side of the continent, and not really too concerned about that. More concerned about mosquitoes and malaria, frankly. But it was wonderful. We were in 5 different game reserves. We spent 15 days on safari doing game drives. We saw everything you can possibly imagine. But I'll tell you what really struck me is when you're 30 or 40 feet away from a cat that if you step out of the vehicle would attack and eat you immediately, but you drive by and they don't even care that you're there. They just yawn and look at you or lay asleep on the ground. It's just amazing to be in that kind of situation. And then a couple of days later, you come by after a kill and you see these same cats eating a wildebeest or a zebra. And you really think about, this is really wild. This is not the zoo where you're protected by this fence or glass enclosure. It was great. We had a wonderful time. We went with a great group, 18 people, and got to make new friends. And you know, the one thing that I always learn when I travel internationally, and that is that I don't care what country it is, the people are just like we are. They care about their families. They want to make a good living. They don't care about politics. They don't care about what's going on in the government. Just let us do what we do, work, make a good living, and they want to be happy. And we met great people there. They were friendly and kind, and I couldn't speak more highly of that experience.
That's great. You know, we had Robert Workman, who's the founder of Goal Zero, in a couple months ago, and he spent a lot of time in emerging countries, and he made a very similar comment about just the spirit of humans and how encouraging that is to see. My guest this morning has been Kent Thomas, founder of Advanced CFO Solutions. Kent, you and I have known each other really since the late 1990s, when my firm at the time, I believe, was one of your first clients. Thanks for your friendship over the years, and thank you for sharing your story with us this morning on The Bottom Line.
Doug, you're welcome. Thank you for having me in. It's been great, a great long-term relationship, and this is what I love about my business. 20 years later, my clients are still my friends.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss, with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.